Hi all, thanks for coming. This panel is on social gaming, social network gaming. And let's see, so we have three panelists here from different parts of the social gaming industry. And also just curious of the people that are here, how many of you play social games already? And how many have not played them but are curious about the phenomenon? Okay. And any other questions, that, you know, burning questions that you guys want to have answered in what we talk about before we start? Okay, yes. Wait, does we have a microphone? Okay.
Are we going to be including, like, wow, that's loud, like iPad games, mobile gaming?
Sure.
In this?
We can.
Okay. We can,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Because they seem to be more into social gaming now as the phone games become more popular.
Okay, we can expand that. So let's start with introductions. My name is Ilanka Dunnan. I work at Simutronics. I've been in the game industry for about 20 years. We've done games in many different sections of the industry, so massively multiplayer games. We had the first online game of the year, CyberStrike, won that award in 1993, was when the category was created. We have a game on Facebook, a social game called Fantasy University, and we also just released an iPhone game. We actually shipped it to Apple about a week ago. And I keep checking my phone to see if it's been approved yet or not. Hopefully it'll be approved sometime during the weekend here. And Tiny Heroes is the name of that game. If it's approved during this panel, that would be really cool, but we'll see. Okay, so that's me, and going on.
Oh, so I'm David Godwin. I'm CEO of Sneaky Games. We're a game studio out in Austin, Texas. I've been building games professionally since about 2003, web-based games, mobile games. And I've been a gamer since I was 9. I'm 39 now. I taught myself to program about that same time. And, that's my background.
I'm Erin. I'm an online game designer and author. This is my book. I would love if you guys would stop by the Pyre booth. We're in the Marquee Ballroom. I write fantasy, and I'm here unofficially because I work for a large social game company whose PR department has not approved me to be here because I forgot to ask, and I realized that in horror, like right after I had talked to Ilanka about it, it's entirely my fault. I would appreciate if no one would tweet anything. That would not get me in trouble. That would be great.
But you do know this session is being recorded and will be out on the internet. So we have Erin, last name unknown.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Oh my gosh! I probably shouldn't be on.
Okay, so you guys can just edit any. So it'll just be like an 18-minute tone for anything that she says, right?
Okay.
we'll work on
the contact.
Okay.
It'll fade to real quiet.
Yeah. So you can just change anything to say is, I've heard that, instead of saying, this happened.
Oh, I totally didn't know you were recording it.
Okay. All right. So let's get a couple cocktails for her, and then she'll be able to speak more freely. Okay.
I did mean to add, also, our two games, I should have talked about them, are Vampire Legacy. We just launched on Facebook. It's a RPG, horror-based vampire hunting type game, and a horror, you know, creature type game, and then the other game is Fantasy Kingdoms.
Okay. Right. And of those of you that are playing games, I'm just going to read off a few Mafia Wars. Who's played Mafia Wars? Okay. What about any of the farming games? Farmville, Farm Town, Happy Farm, of those. Any of the vampire games, social games? Okay. Which of the vampire games do you guys play? Just curious. Was it one of his, or?
I've tried Vampire Wars, and I don't play the vampire game.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. Okay, yeah.
So John is one of our
Do you want to be on the panel?
Yeah, John, come on up. John, come up.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Pipe in when you want to. But John's our lead developer on Fantasy, he did Fantasy Kingdoms. He was one of the lead developers on that, and then he moved over and did Vampire Legacy for us, and he killed it. I mean, we just launched the game. It's a great game, and he did a great job. So.
Okay, and which vampire game are you playing?
I don't remember. It was a while ago.
Okay. Any other games? So, any other games that you guys are just really, really enjoying that you're hoping that we talk about or have questions about? Okay. So the whole social gaming phenomenon is relatively new in the game industry. It really kind of started with Facebook and MySpace, actually. There were games on MySpace and then going on to Facebook and growing. And it's taking off in other countries as well. For example, if you look at kind of a map of what are the online communities out there, Farmville is definitely huge, Farmtown. And in China, the Asian market, it's Happy Farm, I believe is what it's called. There's millions and millions of players. So it's something that we've been looking into as to why do people play these games, what game kind of takes off. It's not a science. If it were a science, we'd all be millionaires at this point because we'd know exactly how to design a game. So it's really kind of the Wild West to some degree. People are kind of throwing ideas out there, seeing what sticks, and then refining things, and then putting a lot of energy into a new game, seeing if it catches on. If not, they move on to another game. So some large companies out there have done games where a fair amount of resource goes into them, and then people just don't play, and then the plug is just pulled, and the game is shut down. What's the typical development cycle, what have you heard is the typical development cycle?
It really is kind of a spaghetti at the wall sort of thing all over the place. It's you do try something, you prototype it fast, you put it out there, and you see how people react to it, and you make it bigger if it works.
How long does it take to prototype a game?
Hopefully it takes no less than 2 or 3 months, you know, to get a prototype, and then you test it internally, and you're releasing it inside 6 months.
Whereas compare that to a standard single-person game that you might find in a brick-and-mortar store, which could take years of development. So the idea of prototyping a social game in 2 or 3 months, why would you say that the cycle is so fast?
I think because you can, because you're actually trying to get a reaction from people before you invest. Because, for instance, we have these giant places like Trion and Gazillion that have put all of this money into making games. Like, they take 5 years, and you have no idea what the market's going to be like. The technology changes so fast, what people want changes so fast, that putting that much investment into a game, the risk is enormous.
Yeah, and there's a big difference between in the hardcore gaming space. You spend millions and millions of dollars building these games, and it takes years to do it. The social gaming space, it's a lot more rapid because it's web-based gaming. The technology is a little bit simpler to get out there, and the time frame's usually 3 to 6 months, and then budgets will go anywhere from a couple $100,000 up to $1 million for most titles. I think some of the bigger studios spend more than that, but for medium small studios, we spend hundreds of thousands versus millions. So.
And that's primarily salaries for the people that are working on the game.
I would say from a budget standpoint, I'd say 70%, 75%, 80% is headcount salaries. Yeah. So.
And it's tough to get that money back because, again, it's not like a brick-and-mortar store where someone's buying a game and you're getting $50 or $60 off of each person. These social games, from people primarily play for free.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to hope that there's going to be some sort of added value, some sort of microtransactions where you'll get revenue back. But 99% of the people who play the game just never spend a dime on it, right?
No.
So you had a question.
Okay. Do you think that time frame is approximately correct for even games like recently came out Sims on Facebook? I think it's called Sims Friends.
It's being recorded. So if you don't talk in the mic, we have to repeat it. So and it's late, and I don't know if I can remember it all. I'll forget his question. Oh no. Okay.
Are games such as Sims or another game that I heard of is called MapleStory that has been recently put up on Facebook, but then those are the big company like EA. Do you think it takes them about the same amount of time, or does it take them longer because it's such a, like, they released it as a like years of development and a really in-depth game? So yep. Do you think the time it takes to make a social game from those big companies about the same?
Yeah, so I think the answer to that question is no, absolutely. Something like The Sims took longer. I'm pretty confident because I had a general idea when they started it, and I think that there's going to be this kind of, as the social gamer matures and they want more from the gaming experience, because what you had is you had this big audience that really didn't game before for the most part. There's a lot of hardcore gamers that play games on Facebook, but there was a huge audience of people that never played games before. They got hooked on Farmville and those type of games. And so I think as that audience matures, you're going to see them expecting more from the games, a better quality experience, which is going to require more budget, more time to develop. So you'll see those games take longer. So those games definitely took longer, I believe. And we're starting to progress that way as well. Like our last title, our first title takes about 3.5 months to develop. Our last one took us about 6 months. And the next title is going to be about the same, and we'll probably move on to bigger, longer titles, and there's going to be some happy medium hopefully in there from a timing standpoint. But
Have we heard anything about how much revenue that the Sims game is getting? Is it turning profitable? Do we have any idea? I haven't.
Yeah, dangerous territory.
Okay. Maybe some other bigger companies have some competitive research, but I don't know is the answer on the Sims itself. I think that, you know, I just read an article yesterday that BioWare is starting to hire up another social gaming team, and they just released Dragon Age social game
Legends,
6 months ago or whatever. Yeah. And so that had to have done decently well for them to want to invest more in it, I imagine. It doesn't take a huge audience to make money. How big your studio is. For us, we're a small, medium-sized studio. Our games are small, medium-sized games, and we're okay with that. And we're profitable and everything else. So, and I think there's going to be a lot of more niche markets appear from these games. Clearly, like Zynga and Playdom and those companies are going after the mass audience. They own the audience already, and they're going to defend that ferociously. I think that they're going to have a harder time getting into the niche space and getting into more of the RPG titles, strategy titles, those type of things. I think they're doing some of that, but they're doing it at the mass market level, and they're trying to appeal to the mass market social gamer more than, you know, we're shifting more towards with like Vampire Legacy, a lot more hardcore audience in our games.
MapleStory is interesting because it obviously took a lot longer for them to do it. I mean, it's not known how long their port took, but there's a lot of games that have tried to just kind of wrap access to their game through Facebook. Typically has not been very successful so far. I can't think of a successful example. They really have to rebuild. It's a fundamentally different type of game than those MMOs, yeah.
Yeah, you have to add a social experience to it. That's the trick. It's taking the hardcore kind of gameplay behavior that even MapleStory had and its or the more hardcore audience, and then putting social mechanics into it. Mm-hmm. It's a very hard thing to do, like retrofit a game to do that.
Speaking about MapleStory, do you know if they had to like fragment their community, because with the whole notion of Facebook, like any money that they bring in through Facebook gets 30%, and then because of the contract with Facebook, all of the money outside of Facebook, if it's the same community, also they get 30%. So is that like, do you know if they?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. If they had to sandbox it or not, I don't know. That would depend on their agreement with Facebook, probably, because I know some of those agreements say that they actually can't have an outside, like you can't have your own website that also accesses the game. So that would certainly, I would imagine, hurt what they're doing, unless they made a completely different game, which is what a lot of them are also trying.
Yeah, you can shard the game out and have your audience, but then the trouble is the audience interacting with each other. And I'm not sure what the Facebook terms are as far as if you can have an audience outside interact with the Facebook audience, but
you can't. Like, we have Fantasy University.
Yeah.
You can log in through Facebook or you can log in through Kongregate, so it's two entirely different entry
different
points, and they're all interacting in the same world.
They can interact.
The terms are okay with that?
We're doing it.
We haven't caught you yet.
Does he have some permission? What?
Right.
Well, sometimes the Facebook terms, for us as developers, the Facebook terms are very hard to track and follow. They've gotten a lot better about communicating these things to developers. And we've worked with them on a few things. I'm sure Zynga and Playdom have, and so it's a trick as far as understanding what's valid and what's not. But MapleStory, if they do share the same world in the two, and I don't know if they do offhand, but they wouldn't have to give 30% of revenue to Facebook for the off Facebook players. So if the player's spending money on the website, they wouldn't have to share that revenue. So.
Questions on that? So the revenue sharing model is interesting. Somebody over there was asking about the iPad games and the iPhone games, and that's, you know, speaking for Simutronics, we kind of looked at what was going on the social market, and we found that just what's called the monetization of the game was so difficult. We made some revenue off of Facebook, we made some revenue off of Kongregate, but we think that we can probably make more money going into a different platform, which is why we went on. So our newest game is this iPhone game, Tiny Heroes. But even that space is being very competitive. Right now, so many apps are being submitted each day. There's 600 new applications that are submitted to the iStore every day. And then they go through a review process, can get approved. If things are going well, it might be approved within a week, or if things aren't going so well, it could take months to get approved. But a game that does well could make thousands, you know, millions of dollars. Our CEO at Simutronics, he made another game just on his off time called Geodefense. And it became huge. It made Time Magazine's list, top 10 games of the year, just kind of a game that he did in his spare time. So the chances of profitability are good there, we think, better than in the social space. But it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, I would say mobile's a growing industry that we're all looking at, because it's just become really hard to grow your user base in a cost-efficient way on Facebook. Just advertising to bring in users, it's very, very hard to get the ROI that's needed on. Right now, the only way to gather users in Facebook is really ad spend, or having a giant network of users already available. So it's really hard to grow a game on Facebook right now. So a lot of independent small developers are looking to mobile as ways to distribute games and make money right now. So.
Is there anyone here that's looking into creating a game for the social space, or has questions about how to design games? I'm just kind of curious. Anybody? No? No question? I see a couple hands here.
Oh.
So, I mean, one question that I have is, like, how restrictive are the, like, just interface requirements for, like, working in a Facebook game versus Kongregate versus other platforms for multiplayer games? Like, do you have a specific set, like, window size that you have to use? Mm-hmm. Can you branch out and, like, can you launch your own window? Like, how particular are they about the interface that you can have?
Well, everything has to fit within that Facebook frame. And so we have a certain size that we can do, and we can scroll within that size. But we're required to have the Facebook menu at the top and to have the ads down the side. We really don't have any control over that. Kongregate also has its own thing. Kongregate also has this thing about having chat, which is kind of nice, because anyone who's playing a game is automatically in a chat window, and they can chat with other people in that game. Kongregate, I think... I'm pausing because I'm not sure if I can announce it yet, but there's Kongregate does things with badges, so as you play different games, you can earn points for playing games, you can earn badges for doing things in certain games, and they have their own promotion system, so it's definitely two entirely different companies. You have to learn how they do things. The Facebook credits, and then Kongregate, Kongregate creds or something, and yeah. So that takes overhead as well, dealing with them, the contract side of it, and any other little gotchas that are going to be there.
Yeah, and Facebook, just mentioning achievements, Facebook just launched last week their Fluid Wall, I think is the name of it, or whatever, whatever they call it. Anyway, it's now they have achievements and stuff in Facebook also for games. So they just added that last week, I believe, or the week before. So that's a new thing worth checking out. And then on that point, most of the portals like Kongregate and stuff, I don't know if Kongregate does, but most of them are now compliant with the Facebook API, and they're also making their size of window the same as Facebook, because Facebook dominates the space. So they're making it real easy for developers, trying to get developers in by saying, oh, it takes you an hour and a half to get to our portal. No, that's never true when they say that, but it's making it a lot easier than having to worry about resizing our application or game. So.
I mean, the games definitely run not on the Facebook servers. They run on either our servers or in the cloud. We keep talking about the cloud.
And then
we link to Facebook. So if you can't get to a game, it's generally not Facebook's problem. Facebook is just providing that shell, and then the game is actually being provided from somewhere else.
Yep.
Okay.
Going back a second, you were talking about the approval process for the Apple Store.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you know of the Android apps approval process? I seem to remember hearing that there really wasn't much of an approval process. You could basically compile an app and just throw it up.
They put any crap up there. That's the answer. No, I'm just kidding. It's getting late. I don't know what they brought.
Not something I know about. Sorry.
I think it is easier. It's an easier process. I don't know if there's actually an official approval that they give or not, but.
With iPhone, there's a long list of approval guidelines that you have to do. You have to make sure that if you say iPhone in the app, that it's spelled properly, that any revenue that's going through has to go through the store. You can't have a special thing like, go to this website and, you know, just give us the money directly and don't go through. You can't do something like that. The application has to be pretty much complete. You can't have placeholder pages. It has to be stable, not crashing. I mean, there's a long, 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 long list of things.
Going back to the panel we had earlier about the violent video game ruling that came out of the Supreme Court, one of the topics that came up was the ESRB ratings and how that's kind of falling behind on technology because they don't rate online interactions. How do you approach rating or controlling your content to make sure that you can sort of properly identify the target market to, say, parents of people who are going to play your games?
Well, that's a great question. As a small studio, it's not something that we've tackled yet, to be honest. It's something that we should definitely be looking at. We definitely don't want to get into trouble for doing that. So one of the nice things about Facebook is it's not supposed to be anyone under, I think, 13 to the age range. But
yeah, we've just assumed that anyone who's on Facebook, the assumption was is that they were an adult, and that Facebook children really weren't supposed to have Facebook accounts, and so we just kind of went with that in terms of rating. But if they, I know there's teenagers on Facebook. Yeah. I've seen them, but I'm not sure it's legal or if the Facebook policies allow for.
You only have to be 14, right?
A 14?
Yeah, 14. Yeah. That's right, 14.
And Facebook actually has some pretty rigid standards for what you can do. Like, it's pretty much child safe. You can't have alcohol references and stuff. It's actually more than you would have even on television or something. So they regulate a lot of that.
My girlfriend is a retired teacher, and she's found several of her elementary school kids on Facebook claiming all kinds of things, like they graduated from Harvard and they're 6'3", and have all these medals from the fire department and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, Facebook has an interesting, some have said, potential looming problem with COPPA and stuff like that, because it's very funny. I remember I worked on kids' games, actually, for Kung Fu Panda World for DreamWorks, and navigating that stream is extremely complex, and there are entire industries that have grown up around sort of heuristically determining whether kids are engaging in things they shouldn't engage in on your service, because you are obligated, you know, to try and make it as safe as you can, and it's wildly difficult to make it safe. And there used to be this standard where if you just basically had a checkbox that basically said, am I 18 or not, you were inducing a child to lie. And so you couldn't do that. So that's why there were sometimes these esoteric things of having to type in your birth date and stuff like that. And even that was said, well, you're basically making them lie and you're not actually stopping them from entering your service. It actually reminded me of the games in the early 90s or so when, did you remember the Leisure Suit Larry games? And they had quizzes in the beginning that had to do with like 1960s and 70s history. Yeah, so if you didn't know the answers, that was like a really bulletproof way, but it's high friction, of course.
Now with Google, it's
exactly
not a good way to
be.
About the child safe, I've seen some sites where it requires a parent's signature or a proof of a parent watching a child. I think
you used to have to fax it. Like there was a fax form for COPPA.
I think Disney, the Club Penguin, I think that was one of them. How efficient is that? You know, how, I guess.
Well, see, the thing is, kids just got past it, because all you had to do was, like, it said, please type in the email address of your parent. And so the 11-year-old's first account, they're going to type in the email address of their parent, and they're going to say, oh, well, I didn't get in, so I'm going to type my own email address in that field. And they don't check to determine whether that's the same email address or not. So it basically was tissue paper.
Yeah, one thing I worked on a few years ago, I worked on a Random House book product called Fairy Godmother Academy. It was a book series. And they had a website, and we were designing games for it and everything. One of the things they did that was really creative is they required a credit card.
Yeah.
They didn't use it, they didn't charge it, but it was like, kids aren't going to have credit cards. So there was no way for them to get there without the... And that's how the parent validated it. And the problem with that is people get online, they're like, well, I don't want to put my credit card in. What do they want it for? You know, and then you lose users because of that. So it's this weird thing of trying to make it frictionless for the consumer to get signed up. But still trying to protect the children. So it's a tough thing.
And we find that when we did that requiring a credit card, kids would just go to their mom's purse or their grandma's purse.
Yep. And they just took the credit card.
But that's
and then you get in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
That's where that comes in, right? It's like...
Yeah, we're constantly getting calls from someone who says, you know, why are you charging me? I've never heard of your company. And we're like... no, you signed up. And they go, no, I didn't. And then we say, okay, do you have any kids in the house? And find out what's going on.
Toontown had a really cool system where they had this sort of double-gated thing where they would give you a code and then you would have to print it out, and then it was trying to prove that you were giving the code to your friend in order to friend connect. So it was this cool way of forcing the connection to be analog.
I know in Korea, a lot of the Korean games, actually pretty much almost all of them, require you to type in your Korean social security number or like the proof of residence number. And even if you click I'm over 13 or I'm over 18, if you type in that number, it says...
Oh, they knew whether you were. Yeah,
it comes out the name and how old you are when you were born. And I know that's going to be kind of really hard to do here because of fraud and identity theft, but do you think that's kind of a good system? Not really like if we used our social security numbers, but maybe like an ID that identifies us. But there's a whole bunch of
backdoors, whole parts loopholes. Of the country that just got angry just because you said that and they felt it.
Yeah, we're on the EFF track, right?
It's an interesting system for sure if you have access to that kind of integration with the government. Yeah.
Have you guys thinking about using like a personal certification from like say VerdeSign, that sort of thing, to verify whether or not an actual adult is using the thing?
Yeah.
I know it's sort of backwards because it's usually it's Facebook or the content provider who's giving you the certificate saying, oh, we are legitimate, log in here, but it's sort of the opposite way of doing it.
It's the friction thing again. I mean, any type of third-party verification that doesn't have critical mass, it's an issue. I mean, short of Facebook doing something different where they're verifying Facebook accounts, that would be really the ideal way to do it for developers, I think. I don't think there's much we can do. We'll do our best to protect it, but to require a third-party service, it breaks the business model of building games almost. At this point, right now. Mm-hmm.
Isn't a lot of it have to do with limiting your liability? Ultimately, if the courts say you've done enough and somebody manages to scam your system and get an account when they shouldn't have, but the courts don't hold you liable for that, well, then you're clear. I mean, ultimately, there's some responsibility on the person at the keyboard.
There is, but at the same time, so from when I was working on Kung Fu Panda, we didn't have to employ this third-party company that specialized in regulating online safety, and their stuff was rigorous. I mean, they had automatic programs that were checking the logs of everything that was going on in the world, that were searching for the use of certain words and pulling people out and banning them. We had moderators on 24 hours a day. We didn't have to do any of that legally, but especially with a kid's world, the perception that parents have of whether your world is safe can make or break you. Like, Club Penguin worked because it was perceived to be safe. Whether it was safe actually or not, it was perceived to be, and so that was what created the market for it. So there's actually a sort of capitalistic connection to making things as safe as you possibly can beyond your liability.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, also just social responsibility. I mean, I don't think,
especially
the group on this panel, I don't think any of us want to have kids in an unsafe environment, even if it's not a liability risk, right? So it's less about the liability for us than just trying to identify
it's horrifying what can happen. Yeah,
I mean, as a side story, I was speaking to a company that their sole job was to do, they did community management, and they did also, they had a service that they would offer game developers called Predator Patrol. Mm-hmm. And they were doing, I forget which game it was, like Lego World or something. It was one of the big online properties that was clearly a kid property. And they would find they had basically, you've seen the Dateline shows where the predators and they fake to be online, kids or whatever. It was the same type of thing. They would go online and pretend to be kids at these games, and they would identify potential predators. And it was like they would boot people. They were telling me it was like 10, 15 people a week would be booted off and like caught like trying to talk to kids and stuff like that. It's a very, very kind of scary... I'm kind of glad we don't do kids' games right now, because it's a very, very tough thing to watch those games and monitor them. And you don't want to be the guy that built the game that some kid gets kidnapped from. You know what I mean? It's just a scary thought, especially as a father too. So
yeah.
And I just had a story. It's not even related to games, but this whack job in Norway that went out and killed a bunch of teenagers. He wrote a manifesto, 1,500-page manifesto, and some of it was about the Knights Templar, and he had copied parts of it from the Wikipedia article about the Knights Templar, which I wrote most of.
Wow.
So looking through his manifesto and seeing what he had about the Templars, and I was seeing sentences that I know I wrote, and it was just creepy as hell to think that anything I wrote would even be read by someone as creepy as that. So
1,500 pages. How many pages was your?
It's like 270. Yeah.
Wow.
He did a lot of copy-paste thing, evidently. Yeah.
Wow.
Did Simutronics ever have issues with stuff like that? Like, was there ever any FBI type stuff or anything?
Oh, I had FBI on speed dial. Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
It
really?
Was constantly. But most of it was dealing with credit card fraud.
Oh, okay. Non-kid stuff for young people? Or
yeah, because people pretty much had to be adults to play our game. There were some children that played, but primarily it wasn't someplace you would go to look for children. It's not something like Lego World or something where if a predator was looking for children. But St. Louis FBI, they've got sort of a specialty in tracking down people who exploit children. And I've been to some of the, I mean, we're getting way far afield here, the original thing. But they really are very serious about tracking these predators down.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard some of the techniques that they use to try and track them, and it reassures me a little bit of how serious the FBI is about this, though I don't envy them their job, because they're like looking for people that are spreading child pornography, which means these agents are having to look at child pornography, and it just gives
Yeah, that was the same with these child protection third-party companies that we worked with, that they said that the people who make the software that determines from the logs, you know, like it pulls out, it's actually looking at case studies, and they have these huge files full of all these case studies of actual crime and stuff like that, and it's just, you couldn't look at it for more than 10 minutes at a time. It just kill you.
Trying to do keyword searches, just making the keywords. One of the FBI agents was saying even making that list, he said it was like falling down a flight of stairs. Every time you do it.
All right, so anyone have any happy questions?
Okay. Anything about flowers, right?
Well, okay, I was going to ask about the credit card fraud, but I'll do something else instead. So shifting gears entirely and talking about game design, I haven't had a tremendous amount of experience with the social games, but almost all of the ones that I have played have been, the term I use is tick-based, but like they dole out access to the game in short bursts over like a relatively short increment of time. Mm-hmm. So what I found as someone who likes to play games sort of optimally or whatever was that I felt like I had to log in every 60 minutes or 55 minutes or whatever, because that was when my allotment would cap and then I could use all my resources and then I'd have to log in again. And so I wonder, is that sort of a model that was devised because you want people to just keep coming back, or is there some other reason for it? And then sort of the flip side of that is, do you feel like that's a moral model because people who are sort of insane about optimizing, like, will stay up all night, or like, you know, sleep in 30-minute increments, or whatever, right? Like, that's sort of those two sides.
Not that you've done that, right?
So I don't play those games anymore because like I did that for a couple days, and I'm like, this is ridiculous.
I don't know what you're talking about that. I mean, there's reasons why I can take a crack at it, and then I'm sure Aaron and Alaka both have thoughts on it. But it's a it's not something that we necessarily love, putting those barriers in play, right? But it's because they're free to play games, we eventually do have to feed our children and pay the programmers and all that stuff. So one of the ways that we do that is by limiting resources. And the reason why that works is, yes, we do want to re-engage you on a daily basis and have you come back and play the game and stay engaged with the game. Another reason is there's right now with social games being at the level they are as far as an experience standpoint is you only have so much content. So we're actually putting gates in place just from a game design standpoint so that you don't consume all the content in 48 hours to stay up all night, right?
Exactly.
And then the last thing is to make money. It's the people that will spend money that do want to have an enhanced experience in the game that are willing to pay, that they can play the game continuously because they can buy energy or whatever the limiter is. And that's my take on it.
Yeah, exactly. And early Facebook games, there's an evolutionary process, almost a Darwinian thing going on with all these games coming out. And early on, before the more advanced games came out, it was gifting. People would just send gifts back and forth, and there was really nothing to it. You would just give someone an egg or something, and then they'd give you an egg, and we'd go back and forth. And then there would be these iterative process of, well, are people continuing to give these gifts, or what can they do, or shopping games, or lottery, and really kind of investigating the human psyche as to what is going to get a person to not just play a game today, but to come back and play that same game again tomorrow. And it was discovered that there were certain very powerful things that could be put into a game. One was limiting the amount of energy that could be available, because then they'd have to come in at another time. In our own game, Fantasy University, we had all kinds of different things that could be a player could purchase. They could get better kinds of armor to wear or a different kind of weapon. But we found that our biggest seller was this thing about adventure points, because someone would get into the game and they'd be play, 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 and then they'd hit the cap. and they'd want to keep playing, and so then they'd have to buy more points in order to keep playing. And it could be a buck here, you know, a buck, just a few more turns, I want to finish this. And that was what brought us in the revenue, which is what made it worth doing the game in the first place, because we weren't making the game as a charity, we're trying to make it as a business.
So I'm going to take the radical game design approach to this and say actually that's the definition of what makes a social game what it is and what makes it a unique experience. And I have argued before that the majority of the experience of a social game takes place outside of the game. It's actually kind of an ARG, an augmented or alternate reality game, where most of your play is taking place when you're not in front of the computer. But you're gaming in your mind, this is what I'm going to do when I get back, and I'm looking forward to it when I get back. And it's a little bit like an eBay auction, right? eBay auctions are kind of exciting. It's like, you know what you're going to get, and you've got to be sitting right there at that moment, and you've got to not spend too much. You want to spend as little as you can and still beat out the other people so you're going to bet at the right time. So that's the same mechanic that's going on, and you're min-maxing in your mind outside of the game. Then you bring it to the game, you have this 5-minute increment. And that 5-minute increment, not only without that, you don't have what a social game is, but then with it, you have a extremely coincidentally mass market friendly experience because it can be played in tiny drips while you're waiting on the phone. Because we spend a lot of time throughout our entire lives waiting for things. When I'm on hold, if I'm in between projects, I'm waiting for somebody to do something at work, I just load up my game, I play it in 5 minutes, and I don't feel obligated to stay. So there's a fundamental difference between fully immersive experiences, like reading a book or playing World of Warcraft, and what this is, which is a game experience that's actually pushed people to do most of the work outside of the game in their own heads.
Another design philosophy question that I think is very specific to social gaming is, how do you approach balancing the nag factor or the wall spam factor of forcing players to get their friends to join the game or participate in the game versus rewarding them for that, and how much of that you actually require them to do to play the game?
That's actually the sad part of the design process. It is, because I feel like we have tried over and over to do things that are like positive, like come back and you'll get this great thing, and people will forget every time. They won't come back. But if you threaten them, if you say come back or else you're going to lose all your stuff, then they'll come back every time. And then they come back and they enjoy it. So, but it is this weird push-pull sort of thing. It's like intrinsically we respond to threat more than we respond to a promise of something good. It's like, well, but if it's going to be there all the time, then I don't need to ever come back at a particular time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's hard.
So in the farm games, I mean, there is something good. You come back and you get to harvest, but if you don't harvest it in a certain amount of time, then your crops all die. So
it's like this weird philosophical thing. It's like without harm or without threat in our lives, we can't experience the joy of coming back and seeing that farm that's fully like thriving, you know? It's like if there wasn't that chance that it might all be dead and we would be really depressed, yeah, then it's not rewarding, it's not fun.
Yeah. And we've in our recent game, we kind of took a different approach. We're experimenting, I guess. We really didn't want to force that mechanic on people where they had to have like 1,000 friends to get past a certain point or whatever in our game. So we took that against probably the wisdom of looking at like the bigger guys and what they're doing. We took that out as a barrier, and what we did is we added it as an accelerator. So like there's some areas in the game where you get to a certain point in the RPG and you explore this area over and over again, right, on the map, and you fight monsters and stuff like that. And you can explore. You get more explore points each time if you have all your friends there to help you. So it takes you longer to get past that point, and it's not even a barrier. You can keep going if you don't fully explore it, but it's kind of a soft barrier, or it slows you down a little bit, and your friends just help you with the experience if they join you. So,
sort of related to the last question, but so most of the free-to-play games have you can use cash to purchase items, better items or armors or weapons. So, but you could still get those armors or items in normal channel by working at the game, you know, logging every 5 minutes or so. So how do you balance between, you know, just using cash to cheat out the game or versus, you know, because people play the game to show other people that, oh, look at this new item that I have. Mm-hmm. How do you balance between, you know, not cheapening out the value of this item that I have versus actually working for it,
yeah,
and vice versa?
That's the Blizzard question.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. And I'm going to give you an obnoxious philosophical answer to it, which is that basically I think you're asking, how do you make sure the game is fair? And if the game is
No, he's talking about fair. No, it's mm-hmm. about not cheapening the challenge
right.
or the value of what I have. Again, toward the bragging rights, sort of.
Right. So, yeah. But if you paid like $100 for an item, would you still say that's not cheap? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think what you have to do is balance the value for the time. And if an item takes a whole lot of time, then it's going to be really expensive. And if you're going to pay for it, it's also going to be really expensive. It's an interesting game design question whether you differentiate between items that take a lot of time. And if you buy that same item, does it look the same in the game? And does that mean that when another player looks at it, they don't know if you worked really hard or you just shelled out $100? And is that a negative experience or not? And I think one thing that hardcore gamers have had a hard time internalizing is that the exchange of time for money is a real thing, and that if people want to spend their time instead of their money, that should be okay. If they want to spend their money instead of their time, that should also be okay.
Yeah, I agree. It's the great debate, right?
Yeah.
It's like, especially in competitive games where you're with your friends and you're fighting them in arenas, and you're like, I've been working my butt off for the past 2 weeks to get this sword, and that dude just bought it for $10 or whatever he spent on it. And yeah, I mean, it's a tough question. We, again, in the new game, we have these weapons that are just a little bit better than what you can get naturally on drops and stuff in the game, where you can, if you spend money, you get a little bit better item. It's a blue item instead of a green item, whatever, right? And then the other thing that we've done that I think is a pretty interesting way to do it is that you can craft items, like really good items, and that's really, really where you get the excellent items. And so you can earn the craft drops, or you can just purchase, you can buy all the ingredients separately. And that's, there's a mental shift there, I think, a little bit. It's like, everyone can still get it, but, you don't know whether they bought it or they,
Yeah, and I think that actually is the Blizzard answer in the consensus, which is that you should never be able to buy your way all the way to the top.
Yeah.
You could buy your way to like 75%, but then 100% always has to be achievement-based.
Yeah.
From a philosophical standpoint, coming from within the industry, at one point there was the huge outcry about the social implications of gaming and do games cause people to do things in the real world. And I would think from being inside the industry, you'd kind of want to step away from that because you don't want responsibility when people do the dumb stuff. But what's the opinion, what's the approach internally for social implications, real-world implications for what you guys do?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, as a social game developer, we really haven't had... I mean, we have a fantasy farming game, so no one's going to do any mass murdering based on fantasy farming, I don't think. But we just launched this vampire game, and so, again, I don't think it was going to kill vampires or anyone's going to cry about that. But I think that it's a big issue, right? I mean, it's kind of like the rock music thing a little bit. Like, it was like everyone's like, oh, metal music, causes people to do crazy bad things. And so it's definitely something that I think personally, I believe studios that are in the hardcore game industry should take responsibility for. There was a big issue around, because it's Take Two that did Bully.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember that? And so there was this game called Bully where it was like, it's Grand Theft Auto, right? But it's like in school and you're supposed to be beating up on kids or whatever. Maybe you protect them. I don't know. But it had some, there was a bunch of press around that and the social implications of, is this really a smart thing for them to be promoting the idea of bullying kids in school and that type of thing? And I mean, I think the press twisted a little bit. I didn't actually play the game, so I don't know, but I heard that it was twisted a little bit beyond what it really was. But if the game was about, promoting bullying in school, clearly I think that's a bad thing. But
yeah, and I think actually contrary to what you said, my personal experience is that developers spend a lot of time thinking and talking about this and fighting about it, and they're on both sides of it. There are developers who say, I will never work on those games that are violent just in case they're violent. And there are people who say, no, this is actually freedom of expression and we need to defend our freedom of expression. If it's okay in a movie, why is it not okay in a video game? And what is the difference? And there's a fascinating long essay written by Richard Rhodes, who I think got a Pulitzer for his work on a book on the nuclear war. But he wrote this long essay about how the United States, at least, was totally shanghaied by this notion that television was violent, or television had detrimental effects on actual behavior, and it was all false. And the studies that it was based on were 12 people in a room that had been bent in a certain direction, and yet it was used by politicians to drum up support on this issue that was totally constructed. And you can look and see that the same thing has actually happened with video games. The rigorous studies that go in and look at it actually say, no, video games do have an effect, but it's not in the way that we think that they have. It's not cut and dry, and they actually have a positive effect as well as a negative effect. They're cathartic and all of these different things. And I think that's what developers tend to talk about a lot, which is that we have a deep insight, I think, into the positive effects of games in ways that other industries don't, and that's what we continually try to advocate for. But there's a lot of introspection, I think, at least in parts of the industry, about, you know, no one wants to know that what they're doing is actually having a negative effect on somebody else.
The research, I'm in total agreement, and the research that I've seen is that, though there's speculation that say, is there a link between a child playing a violent video game and a child becoming violent? Mm-hmm. And that there's no such link, and that the actual research is showing that if a kid comes home from school and they boot up a violent video game, that they're using it just like, you know, an adult might, to kind of reduce stress. Mm-hmm. And you know, it helps them to kind of manage, and then they go on. But it's not influencing their behavior in a negative way. And it's not just about games. Before games, there was you know, rock music,
rock and
or television. I think you can go back
to radio.
Dungeons and Dragons.
And you can go back probably 100 years or more, and there's always going to be somebody complaining that something is corrupting the youth of that day. And right now it's video games. People are saying that the games are corrupting youth.
Like dancing, at least in photos.
Dancing,
yeah, right.
There are actually three great books about this. The best one, I'm actually having trouble remembering the name, but Stephen Berlin Johnson wrote Everything Bad is Good for You, which was an attack on these sort of notions that we have that things were better in the good old days, and he kind of deconstructs that and says, actually, were they better, and was television better? There was a notion that television actually has gotten worse. The truth is, it's actually gotten incredibly more complicated. He has a section on are video games crap media, are they bad for kids, and he deconstructs one of these video games to say, no, actually, what this kid is going through is incredibly complex, and if you look at it step by step and what they're actually experiencing, the reason why they're so engrossed with it is because it's extremely complicated. It's not because it's turning them into a zombie. The other one is by Gerard Jones, and it's called Killing Monsters: Why Children Need Superheroes, Fantasy, and Make-Believe Violence. And it's an extremely kind of emotionally driven study of all of these kids and what they get out of their experiences. And there's a particular part in there about girls and Pokemon that was really fascinating to me, about how girls have a different experience growing up than boys do, and that they're not allowed to express violence. And part of the reason why Pokemon was so successful was because these girls were not violent or aggressive themselves, but their emotions were powerful. The boys would react if they started to cry, and so their actual emotional expression was powerful, and they had these little creatures that were very gentle and soft and cute, but were really dangerous. And girls really resonated with this, and that girls were actually lost by the comic book industry because they didn't capture that kind of expression. So it's complicated and interesting.
Well, it's evident by everything you've shared with us that you put a great deal of thought and time into developing these games. And then there's Cow Clicker.
Yeah.
Written by a friend of ours, right?
It's a researcher over at Georgia Tech.
It's Ian Bogost.
And he put out this paper, of course, we read it, and it was an experiment.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
It was just wildly successful. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it actually irritated him that it worked. He didn't want it to work. Yeah, he made it out of contempt, and then but the mechanics actually did function.
I'm sorry.
It's called Cow Clicker. It was.
And it's the ultimate simplicity to the point of stupidity.
Yeah.
Okay. Basically, it involved this issue of having a certain period of time you could get on, you could click your cow. You had a cow, you clicked on it.
And it was a kind of an ugly cow.
Oh yeah, it was kind of an ugly cow. And over time, you got like a gold cow.
You got a different cow.
And you
rainbow
got
cow.
Different kinds of
gold
cows.
Cow.
And basically, you clicked on your cow. And you got the more you clicked, the cooler a cow you got.
And you could click once a day or something. Yeah.
It was a little bit like Stat Builder. It was like Stat Builder for social games.
Yeah, it was. It's really profoundly stupid game.
Yeah, it is.
And the thing is, he whipped this up in like no time flat and threw it out there as a social experiment. And it became wildly successful, which they weren't exactly sure why. So they're now, there's this whole philosophical thing going on over Georgia Tech trying to figure out why this thing was so successful. how that can be turned into useful work for you all to develop better games, and how the psychology and sociology of these games work, because it really uncovered some very strange behaviors that they're not sure how they work right now.
I'm not sure anybody actually played that game sincerely. You know what I mean?
I only played it as a joke.
Yeah, what he did was he actually tapped into this audience that had incredible rage about social games. And so they expressed their rage through CalClicker, and he had an audience, you know? So whenever you have something that becomes super big, you're going to have a countercultural movement that's going to try and resist it. And so I think he just tapped his audience that way. I don't know, maybe his study will reveal something.
Yeah, I'm not sure the success could be repeated with, like, Hamster Clicker.
No, you can make, I mean, unless it was people who liked CalClicker, like Hamster Clicker.
I don't know, you have Angry Birds, so, you know.
Angry Birds is an excellent game, though.
I saw someone playing it on the plane here.
Yeah.
The guy in front of me was playing
it's
Angry
twitchy.
Birds.
I've handed it to family members, and it's a point of no return, you know.
I just wanted to throw in a quick comment on the kind of violence and design and trepidation issues with kind of the whole false dilemma with Congress and people and everyone else involved in this on a couple of levels. I mean, one, back to our childhoods and watching, you know, Bugs Bunny or whatever, and the coyote go off the cliff. You know, we didn't have an 80% suicide rate of 5-year-olds, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, because we're all smart enough to realize that that was a cartoon and we didn't hurt ourselves.
Cartoon physics.
Right. Okay, one. But then two, on a more direct scale, in a much larger industry that pads the pockets of whole bunches of people, is auto racing or professional football or anything else,
or cigarettes,
where people are jazzed up not only on extreme amounts of violence or competitiveness, and even competitiveness of the fans around them, are then incented with alcohol or whatever else is with them, and are driving an actual murderous weapon in their vehicle home while loaded or while in that extreme pit. You know, you just watch cars at 200 miles an hour clash. Well, what are you going to do? Well, you know, we don't kill 10,000 people on the way home from the races either. But yet it's a direct stimuli of the same thing, and some people go to, you know, half the races on the schedule. So, you know, it's one of those things we need to balance, that there are lots of real life experiences that go on every day that are around the same topic. Yeah. But of course, because, like you say, whether it, you want to put it as the footloose factor of, well, it's our kids and, you know, apple pie and whatever else. No, we live this every single day of our lives, and here's just some other examples, except you like the way you make those billions of dollars, and, you know, you have a sense this is something new, and we need to dislike it or control it.
Yeah, you just reminded me of, like, I was thinking back on that when we've had discussions like this about kids and protecting them, and how do we do that? And even, I mean, day to day with my wife and our kids, and, like, do we let them do this? Do we let them watch this show? Whatever. And, you know, I mean, thinking back to when I was a kid and me and my friends watching those karate movies that were so popular back in the day, the cheesy karate movies, and we'd go, we'd go down to the store and buy, like, real Chinese stars and throw them at each other and stuff. And, but we didn't want to go throw them at other people. I mean, we were, like, playing, you know, and no one got killed from it, you know, whatever. So I think that there is, I mean, I think there's a, you know, we definitely need to be diligent in protecting them, and maybe it's the surveillance of the games and those type of things.
Right. It's not that you're unaware to it, but it's just acting like that this is some great new social disease that, you know, is instantaneous in effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you want to talk about immoral. I think exploiting our intrinsic fear of new things is immoral. You know, I think it holds us back, and it's a distraction from much more important things. I think that people have a basic biological fear of things that are unknown. Is that a controversial statement? Yeah, and I think that to exploit that by saying, hey, you've never heard of this and it's killing you, I mean, the 6 o'clock news does that all the time, and the politicians are doing that with games as well. It's people who are unfamiliar. Wow. It's okay. The rebellion of the technology.
I can change the battery and the microphone. Okay.
Yeah.
That was it.
The unfamiliar.
The fear of the unknown. That was there. We have the
exactly.
Unknown.
Yeah.
We will never touch a mic again.
So I guess we're getting close to time. One last question is the future of social gaming. Do you have any predictions?
I think he was going to ask a question on that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Someone else?
Oh, okay.
Did you want to go ahead and do it? And we'll repeat it.
Okay.
I was going to bring up an example of something from the 70s where we had all these wonderful prophecy teachers talking about how computers were going to enslave us and all that.
Yes.
And now just about everybody has one on their desk and they're enslaved you now.
Yeah.
I am a slave to my iPhone, yes.
in a different sort of way. Yeah.
Or another question, the science fictional question is, have we become a different species depending on the way that we augment ourselves with technology?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, even the minister who was saying that computers were tool of devil
had one. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's a good point. So, all right.
Any thoughts about the future?
The future of social gaming? I think that Zynga has won the battle in the mass market, right? So if you like that, and then I think what's going to happen is I think all their games are going to be great as they go forward because they're doing a great job of it. I think that what's going to happen though also is that game players play, especially on the social front, play multiple games, and I think that people are going to start fragmenting a little bit and start looking for kind of they're going to realize that, oh, there's these general social games that are very casual in nature, and then they're going to go, okay, I like fantasy novels or whatever, and they'll start moving towards a little bit harder core experiences, and you'll start seeing some more game studios, especially the smaller independent studios, building games that are not in the same playground as Zynga, because it's not a safe place to be. And right now, especially with the Facebook ecosystem the way it is, Zynga played... really, those two are really the ones that can thrive. Digital Chocolate, maybe, but there's a few studios that can do really well in the big mass market space. You're gonna see some more. The good news is we're gonna see a lot more games. There are gonna be a little bit more there's gonna be just a lot more variety of games. So I don't think that you're gonna see as many clones as you've seen in the past, because I think that not everyone's gonna be going after the farming game. And after that, I think people are gonna start trying to experiment in different areas and building different types of games. That's kind of where I think it's heading right now.
Yeah. I would hope, and this is stolen from Brenda Brathwaite, who's a game designer, that this is the coming age of the game designer, which is an exciting thing, that we are no longer as limited by technology or distribution as we have been in the past. It's easier and faster now to just make a game if you want to make a game, and that's an extremely exciting thing. From someone who has gone from consoles to massively multiplayer online games to social games, you have more direct interaction with your customer than you've ever had before. The stream is more or less direct, even if Facebook takes a piece of it. You're not beholden to distributors or publishers in the way you were before. So I hope that we see many more interesting games, and we see a flourishing of all kinds of really interesting social games if more developers can kind of get over their squick about social games, and I think that is happening, so yeah. I'm hopeful.
Yeah. For myself, it's interesting and kind of where are people going to be going? Mm-hmm. Facebook, huge now. Google's now on the scene with Google+. How's that going to be affecting things? MySpace used to be the big player on the block, and now hardly anyone talks about MySpace. Before that, Friendster. Anybody remember Friendster? So a few years
Orkut.
From now,
Orkut.
Orkut. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Google had its chance.
And the mobile platforms also.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Mobile social is going to be interesting.
It's just another ecosystem. The Apple, and that's where the free to play games will be going as well. So.
Yeah, I think the definition of a social game is going to be changing right now, especially with the mobile technology. Things like Foursquare, and on Facebook as well. I'm noticing people are checking in. We were talking about this. People want to say where they are and what they're doing, and maybe get points for what they're doing. And so that whole kind of game aspect of it, I think, is going to be growing. So the populace, I think, there will always be a certain percentage of people that want to play a game, want to have fun, want to be entertained. But the definition of what is a game and how much time they're going to be spending on a game or any one game, I think that's going to be changing greatly over the next few years. As technology changes with it, we don't know, iPhones today, what are we going to be carrying around a few years from now? Is it all going to be iPads or some device we've never even heard of?
Planted on our eye.
Right?
That'd be awesome.
There we go. So I can't lose it.
That's right.
Okay.
The game is you.
Cool. All right. Yeah. So on that note, thank you all very much for coming. It was an interesting talk. We can continue with that. I didn't know if you guys wanted to... One more question. Okay.
What games are you guys playing right now?
Oh, SimSocial.
Sure. What did you say?
Oh, SimSocial. I actually picked up Rhythm Heaven. I hadn't played Rhythm Heaven for Nintendo DS. Such a neat little game. It's actually more like a bag of little game experiments than it is a game itself, but it's a lot of fun.
I've been playing, personally, I've been playing a lot of our games because we've got three games in production. We just launched Vampire Legacy. So I've been doing a lot of testing and playing on those games. And then personally, I play Rift, the MMO Rift, a lot. And then I've also picked up this really throwback kind of pixel-based game called Realm of the Mad God.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a
Sprite
great,
Fox.
Yeah, it's a great game.
Yeah, that's cute.
And then there's some good mobile ones out. Pocket RPG is a good one. I can't wait for Tiny Heroes to come out. Waiting to play that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then what else? Well, there was one more mobile game that I was just really raving about the other day. That was Pirates. Sid Meier's Pirates came out on mobile. So
oh, have an iPad.
Yeah, on iPad.
Yeah, I haven't cracked it open, so I'm afraid of it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That's what I'm afraid of.
So yeah. So anyway, and we brought some free pins from Vampire Legacy if anyone wants any the kind of clever sayings, or I think they're clever. And so if anyone wants any souvenir pins.
Games I've been playing, as you mentioned, I've got this new game, Tiny Heroes, which is in the tower defense genre. So I've been playing tons and tons of tower defense games lately. It's horrible being in the game industry and having to do this kind of research all the time, playing these games.
What do you like? Favorite one?
Plants vs. Zombies.
Oh, yeah.
The first time I played it, I didn't like it. And then I played it again, and I just got hooked. And I played it all the way through on the PC. I played it on the Nintendo Wii. I played it on the iPhone. And I loved it. I was fascinated by the ways that they were kind of changing it, making it a little bit different for each of the platforms. Mm-hmm. I play a lot of puzzle games, Gem Quest, Paradise, Gem Sweeper. Those are mine. And Star Wars Lego. Never get tired of that one.
That darn Blizzard and their Flame Ward Hippogriff has made me want to go back and start playing. They released a new Hippogriff, and they emailed me about the Hippogriff. Don't email me about the Hippogriff. I don't want to know about that.
Any other questions?
Yep.
Okay. A great audience. Good questions.
Thank you
very much.